From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, ET Chronicles. Here's what's happening. Well, that major cyber attack we've been talking about on U.S. federal personnel data was far graver than the Obama administration has acknowledged, with hackers apparently obtaining information on every federal employee. In a letter to the Office of Personnel Management, J. David Cox, the national president of the American Federation of Government Employees, said that based on the information provided by the OPM, the hack was much broader than previously thought. The OPM, which acts as the Human Resources Department for the federal government and conducts more than 90% of all federal background checks, said last week that it had detected a cyber intrusion into its systems that happened back in April, and that the information of 4 million current and former federal employees had been compromised. Now, this was the largest data breach in federal government history, and they think China may have been the one. The Senate has failed to advance legislation to strengthen protections against cyber attacks, as Democrats banded together to oppose the measure's inclusion in a defense policy bill President Barack Obama has threatened to veto. By a 56-40 vote, the lawmakers decided largely along party lines not to move ahead with the measure as an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act. Lauren Weinstein, of course, the expert on the internet. Lauren, this hacking episode, it's bigger than they thought.
I'll tell you, George, the more you hear about this one, you have to wonder about the clowns coming out of the little car. How many can come out? How often?
I know it.
The situation with OPM is just, let me put it this way. If OPM were a private corporation, in most states, they'd be facing not only criminal charges, but incredibly large fines. I mean, no major corporation would operate the way OPM has, apparently going back many, many years, probably multiple administrations. What we're hearing now is, I mean, it's like a litany. It would be funny if it wasn't so tragic. We're hearing there was virtually no encryption. There was no security staff until 2013. They were just using simple logins and passwords, not even the kind of two-factor verification we've talked about, like you can get on Google and
yeah,
such,
simple.
Where there's ways to protect yourself better. They weren't even bothering with that. And apparently, whoever the hackers were, and it was, you know, they're saying it was probably China, and that could well be the case. They not only got hold of the names and the SSNs and the dates of birth and all that kind of stuff, but apparently they also got hold of what are called the SF-86 forms. And those are the ones that are used when people apply for federal jobs where they have to have background checks.
Mm-hmm.
These 120-something-odd page forms where you basically explain everything you had for breakfast for the last 30
Jeez.
Years.
I wonder if there are CIA people in that data.
Intel sometimes is kept kind of compartmented, but sometimes not, because people move back and forth between jobs. They may be in the Foreign Service, and then they may move into Intel and back and forth and such. The interesting thing about this, outside of just the debacle of the horrendous security. Oh, and by the way, I'm hearing now that the way they discovered this, the first stories they said, well, we were running a security audit, mm-hmm. and that's how we found it. Well, what I'm hearing is that they were actually getting a demo of some commercial security software, and in the middle of the demo, this popped up.
Oh, jeez.
That's kind of interesting. Anyway, the thing about China is, if it is China, for example, I don't think people have to worry about identity theft and things like that. You know, China isn't going to be stealing
your
credit card information. They are building dossiers. They you know, for intel purposes. They want to know who's who, where, what, when, because they never know when somewhere down the line that's going to be useful to them in a tight spot, you know, when there's a diplomatic situation or for their own intel operations. Now, keep in mind, though, it's not at all unlikely that Western countries, including the United States, may do similar things
That's
when they
true.
Can opportunistically. If they can find their way into other countries' addresses and information about their foreign nationals and all of that, they're probably going to be doing that, too. So it's spy versus spy. it's a terrible situation, and it's just, you know, if this was some kind of sophisticated hack, you could say, okay, well, it needed to be done. You know, you needed more protection, and you needed fine tuning. But this looks like it was just gross negligence at this point, and that's a lot harder to understand.
All right, Lauren, thank you. Eating half a handful of nuts every day could substantially lower the risk of an early death, according to a Dutch study. Previous studies had already indicated that a link with cardiovascular health, but this is the first to look at specific nuts and diseases. Researchers found a 23% lower chance of death during the 10-year study in people eating at least 10 grams of nuts or peanuts a day. No benefits, they say, from peanut butter. Forecasters estimating a 55% chance of a geomagnetic storm Friday when a coronal mass ejection is expected to hit the Earth's magnetic field. It's not a big one, so don't worry yet about the power grid. A decades-old gun law in Connecticut requiring residents to have a permit before purchasing a handgun is credited with helping to reduce the state's firearms-related homicide rate by 40%. According to a new study, the legislators in the Constitution State implemented the handgun purchaser licensing law back in October of 1995 as well. The study found that a large drop only in killings involving guns, not in homicides carried out in other ways. Let's check in with John Lott, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. John, what's your take on this study?
A pretty poorly done study. It's out of the Bloomberg School of Public Health. And, you know, if you look at the years prior to the law going into effect, the firearm homicide rate was actually falling at a much faster rate. And so when the law was implemented, it actually slowed down the rate of drop that was there. And you have to compare it relative to other states. If you compare it to other states in the Northeast, for example, when Connecticut adopted this law, its firearm homicide rate actually went up relative to neighboring states. And if you look at other types of crimes, like violent crime, or if you look at robbery or aggravated assault, those types of crimes were actually falling prior to the law being implemented and started rising afterwards. People can see the graphs if they go to our website at crimeresearch.org.
Is the attack on handgun ownership still underway, John?
I mean, you see it all the time. And this isn't the only time that they're willing to go and make false statements. It just came out a week ago, that study that you and I had talked about from right before the election last year, where the FBI was claiming that there was this increase in mass shootings.
Right.
I had written an article in a criminology journal because I hadn't been able to get any response from the Justice Department or the FBI or the authors of the study for the problems that I had. They finally responded in the Criminology Journal last week and admitted that there were just errors in their data. They had no defense for any of the errors that were there. The Wall Street Journal just wrote this up a couple days ago. I mean, it's absolutely flabbergasting. I mean, this is something that was given massive news coverage from front page of the New York Times to the Wall Street Journal to USA Today, all the major news broadcasts led with it when it came out. And yet now, they refuse to answer questions for months. I mean, I tried like 15 times to get responses from the Justice Department and the FBI and these authors. It was only when they were kind of embarrassed in front of their peers that they finally responded, and they had like no defense of the errors that they had in the data. I mean, it's really, you know, one hopes other than just the Wall Street Journal will write a retraction on this.
Okay, John. And you can track John's work, by the way, with his blog, which is linked up at coasttocoastam.com's Twitter feed. Country music singer Randy Howard has been killed in a shootout with a bounty hunter trying to detain him for a fourth offense with a DUI, possession of a drug, and possession of a firearm while intoxicated as well. Several media outlets report that the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation is looking into the shooting of the 65-year-old Randy Howard. Howard has performed with country music stars such as Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings. Sir Christopher Lee, the veteran actor and star of many of the world's biggest film franchises, has died at the age of 93. The English-born actor, who made his name playing Dracula and Frankenstein's monsters in horror films, appeared in more than 250 movies. One of wrestling's most colorful stars, Dusty Rhodes, the self-styled American Dream, has died at the age of 69. They are not releasing the cause of death for him. President Barack Obama's quest for fast-track negotiating authority on a Pacific Rim trade deal has passed its initial tests in the House of Representatives ahead of a final vote on Friday. But what does this all mean? Because lots of people are very unhappy with what they call TPP. Up next, Robert Morningstar joins us. Plus, if you get a moment, get up to our website, coasttocoastam.com, and look at some of the images that Robert has sent us. We'll be talking about them, too, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you and our special guest, Robert Morningstar, civilian intelligence analyst, psychotherapist from New York. He's also an FAA-licensed pilot. Robert has studied the paranormal and UFOs for more than 40 years. And he has written extensively to expose NASA's use of disinformation technology. And here he is back on Coast to Coast with a handful of things. You've got so much to talk about, almost don't know where to start, Robert, but we got to get into this fast-track Trans-Pacific Pact. How you been?
I've been pretty well. I'm happy to be here, and I think this is a historic night, George, because I'm trying to turn you and your show into Paul Revere. And I'm sure you'll agree with me when we finish discussing
it. Here we come. Well, why are so many people concerned about, opposed to, yet we see it passing, as we have just talked about, the Trans-Pacific Pact? And kind of explain, Robert, what the heck this is.
Let me begin by saying this. The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secrecy. Societies and secret oaths and secret proceedings. We are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice. Those are not my words, those are the words of President John F. Kennedy. Spoken on April 27, 1961. And those words are more true today and prophetic than they were that day he spoke them on April 27th at the Waldorf Astoria. And I can go point by point showing you how everything that he said in those two paragraphs is coming true right now here in our own country. He was speaking, obviously, about the communist conspiracy. But we have another monolithic and ruthless conspiracy, which is the global finance system that has usurped power in our country, that is trying to mute dissent. The reason I'm speaking to you on this subject today is that there is a very courageous congressman. There are several very courageous congresspeople. But one stands out in my mind because it was he who alerted me to the threat posed by TTP. And his name is Congressman Alan Grayson of Florida. In August of 2014, I have to say, the most serious letter that I have ever received from a congressperson. And the reason that it struck me was the sense of urgency and the threats that the congressman expressed, that he had been exposed to threats if he divulged the contents of what he had been allowed to read.
Physical threats, Robert, or some kind of political threats?
Well, political threats and legal threats. They threatened to charge him with treason.
Oh, boy.
If he should divulge, and not just him, any and all congresspeople, senators and congressmen and women, have been told the same thing, that if they were to divulge the secret protocols that remain hidden. Only six of them have been released publicly, but there have been a lot of leaks, and now we have a good handle on what's involved. So I have on my Facebook page, I have a letter from Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Edwin Markey to the U.S. Trade Representative Ambassador Michael Froman, expressing their concern about something that is called the investor-state disputes. And this is how investing corporations, foreign corporations from the other, the 11 TTIP nations, would conduct disputes. And these would be held by panels of lawyers that would stand above and apart from the American courts.
I was going to say, they're circumventing the court system, aren't they?
Exactly so. Exactly so. This is only one of the problems with the treaty, as they want to call it, or the partnership. I call it a pact. I'm having an argument with someone on the internet who says, stop calling it a pact. It's the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I said, partnership is open. The secrecy around this treaty is what makes it a pact, as in pact with the devil. And I really am concerned with it, because why would Congress people be threatened with treason for divulging to us their constituency?
It makes no sense. Yet it seems to be passing, and we'll find out tomorrow for sure, but it seems to be overwhelmingly in favor in the Congress.
Maybe they're all afraid. No, it's not overwhelming. The thing is very close, and there are still six Congress people who are fence-sitting. I've listed their names. The names were given to me by Congressman Grayson in asking me to bring it to the attention of the American people and to ask us to call these Congress people.
We've been calling Congress all week. We're trying to protect the power grid, too.
Of course.
Jeez.
So this is the wonderful thing about a real electronic democracy. We have this power now in our hands, the computers on which you're listening to this program, the telephones that are being used. You have to assert your power. I called my congressman, Gerald Nadler, and I expressed to his office and his secretary the seriousness of this situation, and I cited the threats. And perhaps that's why so many are going glad-handedly along in the Congress. The threat has been posed to every single one who's been allowed to read or who has asked to read the treaty.
You know, Robert, if you went out on the street and did a man-on-the-street poll, I bet, and if you asked everybody, what is TPP, what does it mean to you, I bet 98% of the people out there would have no idea what you're talking about.
Of course, and it sounds so innocuous. You know, there is a pattern of dressing up secret projects, black projects, with coded names, and we're going to get into some of that in the next hour, that put your guard down or compel you to go along for fear of saying, no, I don't support the Patriot Act. Wow, I don't support the Patriot Act? Oh, that must make me unpatriotic. Not at all. So the other one is the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA.
Mm-hmm.
And when people don't pay attention to these things, tricks are foisted upon them. And the worst thing about the NDAA is the clause that cited that the United States, the continental United States, is now a battleground and American citizens are considered combatants, enemy combatants. And this would explain so much of the behavior of the police.
And you can arrest them without trial.
Arrest them without trial. Shoot them on fear. I was afraid. I'm a cop. I was afraid. I shot him because I thought he was going to pull out that Walkman out of his pocket. That poor young man shot last week. I believe it was in Utah or Nevada. He was just walking along with his iPhone plugged into his head. And the cop yelled at him, screaming, get it, stop, stop, stop. He just turned around, and he couldn't hear him because the music was so loud. So he reached down. And he was shot to death. The video is right there on Facebook.
Well, that tells you also how uptight police officers are, Robert.
Exactly so. Now, why would that be? Because they have been indoctrinated under the NDAA to believe that we are the enemy.
Hold on, Robert. We're coming back for more. Robert Morningstar. We're going to talk more about the TPP. And then we're going to talk about some of these unbelievable images he has sent us. How about a 1951 UFO sighting near Korea? Unbelievable. Well, I got a notice from a small network that wants to interview me about ParanormalDate.com. They said, we have never seen more people call us for something like this. Hey, what it is, it's something for you to get to know people of like minds. It is free to sign up. If you decide to stay, use the coupon code George, please, to save yourself a lot of money. Just go to the website, ParanormalDate.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Now, they say the fast track of the TPP unconstitutionally restricts Congress from holding hearings, conducting investigations, debating a bill, and offering amendments. In fact, it would limit House members to only about a minute and a half seconds. That's it, a minute and a half, that's it, of debate. Robert Morningstar with us here. Robert, this is amazing. How do they bury this stuff in there?
They've been going at it for years. The letter that was written by Senators Warren and Markey dates back to last beginning of last year, and I don't think they've gotten a response. I'd like to say no president should fear public scrutiny of his program, for from that scrutiny comes understanding, and from that understanding comes support or opposition, and both are necessary. Without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed, and no republic can survive. Again, the words of President John F. Kennedy on April 27, 1961. How pertinent, how important those words remain today. Because you were talking about all this secrecy, and the things that he describes is exactly the behavior that we are seeing in our government and in the financial institutions, the cabal that is running the show in Washington. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silence, not praise. No expenditure is questioned. No rumor is printed. No secret is revealed. Can anything better describe what we have been seeing the last few years of the Obama administration? When we think about preparations are concealed, not published, mistakes are buried, like the Benghazi. What about the emails? Buried by Mrs. Clinton in her private server. Friends, this is the conspiracy that President Kennedy was speaking about in 1961. Make no mistake, this is the same enemy that President Kennedy described as operating on, relying on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence. What could be more covert than hiding the treaty and threatening those who have read it with prosecution for treason?
Are you on a New York street, by the way?
Well, this is, I'm on the third floor in New York, and you may hear fire engines, the traffic, maybe even street fights.
It's real. Okay. I thought you were out there on the streets.
Yeah, on the street where I live.
Now, what's your gut tell you, Robert? I think it's going to pass.
No, I am going to fight all the way through tomorrow to see that this doesn't pass.
I know, but what's your gut tell you?
My gut tells me that it's not going to pass.
All right.
If my gut didn't say that, I wouldn't be on the show.
Let's see if you're right, because I've been getting emails about this for the past month, and they're starting to get more and more. And nobody really has been talking about it nationwide. Nobody, it's just like it's going to get voted on and that'll be it.
Well, that's what President Kennedy said. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. This is one of the most important speeches that any president ever gave. And I feel that it was so prophetic that he was seeing, he foresaw the consequences of allowing subversion, because it is nothing less than that. Is they are subverting the Constitution, they are subverting the nation. Because, George, what defines us as Americans is the Constitution. If we have no Constitution, if it's watered down, we don't have our Bill of Rights, we don't have the protections. We're out naked in the open, just like Europeans, vassals of the state. The difference between the American system and the European system is that the American system believes that we have God-given rights, that our human rights proceed from the Creator. The European states, in the wake of the French Revolution, believe that the state grants rights and that humans have no divine rights endowed by their Creator. And what we have allowed to happen is allowed a very subversive and seductive form of socialism to subvert the Constitution. And the subversion has taken place in law, in the military, in economics. But we still have a chance to stop it. We have to bring this pact and its hidden protocols, secret protocols, to see the light of day before any action is taken on it. And the Congress has to get its courage up, its dignity, its self-respect, and stand up to the president. The Congress, if allows this fast-tracking prerogative to the president, is surrendering powers that were conferred upon it, upon the Congress and the Senate, by the Founding Fathers.
All right, let's make a side bet, you and me.
Okay.
I think they're going to pass it. It'll get to the president's desk and he signs it.
Okay.
Just a guess. I'm not saying I endorse it by any means.
I understand, you know that. But I'll stand against that. I think that enough people have heard, and it's always this way in the United States. You know, it's always at the last minute. That's why I likened you and your show tonight to Paul Revere. It's our chance.
And we may well be. I mean, some congresspeople may hear this. Some senators may hear this.
I alerted several congresspeople to tell them that I would be speaking on the show and to tune in and to tell their constituencies to listen. And I'm encouraging everyone on Facebook, and many, many, many of my friends on Facebook have great followings, and I've alerted them. And it's my hope that tomorrow, that somebody will look at that list of six congressmen, three from California, two from Texas, one from Colorado, one from Delaware, another one from Maryland, who have been vacillating. And isn't it remarkable? Here's another tip-off that something's really wrong here. The Republicans are acting as if President Obama is a Republican, and the Democrats are opposing him as if he were a member of the opposition party. Doesn't that tell you something?
Yeah, it's strange.
There's something totally unnatural about this.
Now, what else is strange? You sent us some incredible pictures that we have up on the coasttocoastam.com website, beginning with an unbelievable UFO case in 51. Tell me about this.
Well, this is a remarkable photograph. I've improved the quality of this photograph, and I actually cropped it. And it comes from a South Korean UFO site that I came across that had the most remarkable collection of photographs, including this picture, which in its full size shows a what we call a B-26 in World War II. Flying over the mountains and hills of Korea, and this UFO is just practically sitting on its nose, and the photo was taken from another bomber that was accompanying it. The plane actually looks like it was a bomber in World War II and was probably a reconnaissance plane in Korea. And this gigantic, excellent quality photograph it was posted by a South Korean UFO website. So I downloaded it and cropped it and improved it, and it looks to me, if you compare that with the blueprints of the Haunabu flying saucers that the Germans had, it looks to me like the Haunabu 3 in every detail, including the cupola and the slope and the curvature of the craft and the underbelly and the undercarriage, if they landed on those pods. It's quite a fantastic photograph.
And Robert, tell me, because you sent us a photograph of the Rosetta Stone.
Yes.
Tell me, what's the tie-in?
Okay. For 70 years, no one's known what Haunabu means. You know, the secret name of the German flying saucer projects, they had really unusual names. One was Haunabu, and the other one was Vril, V-R-I-L. And these were the circular wing flying saucer anti-gravity craft that the Germans were working on. And this strange word, Haunabu, was inscrutable. No one could figure out what it meant. Somebody thought it had to do with a town called Haunaburg. However, while reading the Rosetta Stone and the 17th decree of Ptolemy V, one of the pharaohs, in the very last paragraph, I came across the meaning of the Haunabu. And it comes in the 17th decree when Ptolemy V, Epiphanes, the pharaoh of Egypt, who has put down a rebellion by a very, very revolutionary temple that refused to bow to him and to pay tribute, and he put it down over a long, long siege, but without bloodshed, because it was his jubilee, and he didn't want to mar it with civil war. So he was able to overthrow and subdue the rebellion, and then he forgave most of the malefactors. He only arrested the leaders. But then he had this decree made that the story should be told of his jubilee, what had happened, how great a pharaoh he was. And the jubilee was actually a tax break for a year for all the Egyptians, his followers. So as this story unfolded, I was amazed, because what the Rosetta Stone did is it filled in the missing time in human history, an incredible epoch of time that was lost in antiquity. It was only because the Rosetta Stone was discovered by Napoleon's men, and then taken to France, and then taken to England and deciphered, that we know anything about Akhenaten, monotheism, SETI, Ramesses. It was just a blank, which led Graham Hancock to describe humanity as a species with amnesia. And other psychiatrists said that we had this missing person in history, these missing people, and we had to fill them in with mythology. Well, in the last paragraph of the Rosetta Stone, the 17th decree, he mandates that the decree and the story of his jubilee be inscribed on stone, on wood, on metal, and on paper, on papyrus, and that it should be written in the three languages, the language of the gods, hieroglyphics, the language of the priests, which was called demonic, and the language of the Haunabu. And I jumped out of my seat when I saw that word. The Haunabu was a reference to the Greeks. That was the Egyptian name for the Greek, the people, seafaring people of the Aegean, the Greek tribes, Hellas. And so I had this insight that the Germans came to the ancient alien conclusion that we are now receiving every week on the History Channel, and it's becoming more and more coherent. But the Germans were smart enough to realize that the ancient gods were spacefarers and they were technologists, and they saw themselves as the descendants of these gods.
Were they working with reverse technology, Robert, or
They were working with Tesla technology. They had gone off. You see, they had gone off into a totally different field of physics. They went into a totally different cosmology. They rejected Einstein. You can get the story of what was really going on in the Germans' psyche, the German scientists' heads, if you read a book called The Morning of the Magicians, which I read way back in the 1960s, and I was shocked to realize how way out the Germans were in their concepts of cosmology and quantum physics, to the point that it was just the inverse of everything that we believe in the West. They followed a German philosopher physicist named Hans Horbiger, and he believed in this theory of fire and ice. We would call it yin and yang, you know, in Chinese jargon. But that these opposing cosmic forces of fire and ice were in eternal war, and that the universe was shaped like a giant sphere. It was like a ball of ice on the outside, and all of creation rested on the inside of this cosmic sphere. So if you really want to learn about what they thought and what they believed, as crazy as it sounds, their physics worked better than what we were doing in similar fields. So
did we luck out when we defeated the Germans? Because it seems like if they had this kind of technology, Robert, they were on a roll.
I think it was only a partial victory, George. Honestly, I have come to believe that Hitler did survive the war. I downloaded a file from the FBI website, which I encourage everyone to go to FBI.gov and CIA.gov and NSA.gov. They have these reading rooms with declassified files. And I came across a report that was given by an Argentinian to the FBI that was reported directly to Hoover, that reported that he had been along on this expedition that received Hitler and the party, several women, about 50 people, coming off two U-boats off the coast of Argentina, and led them on a trek, you know, through the jungles into a safe house, safe area.
And they even built him a mansion, didn't they?
They did. Yeah. And then there's, of course, a story of Neues Schwabenland and all the submarines that disappeared and wound up surrendering in the Southern Hemisphere, many of them sailing into Argentina to surrender after World War II. So I do believe now that a remnant of the Third Reich did survive. We know about the Spinne. And the Odessa File, if you see the movie, they're really telling you the truth about a remnant surviving Nazi organization, which was the original military-industrial complex, by the way. I've read the story of his biography, actually. Albert Speer was the principal architect of the Third Reich. And he was tried at Nuremberg, and he was spared. His life was spared, and he spent many years, 20 years or more, in prison. And when he emerged, he wrote his memoirs. And the thing about Speer was he was a genius in logistics and organization, and he was the one that was able to make the Third Reich last into 1945. His genius was so great at industrial organization that the Allies, when they realized what he had done, they said that if they had known that he was the one that was doing it, they would have sent bombers just to get him.
Robert, we're going to take this break. We'll finish up, and then we'll take some calls as well in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.